I head up an organization called SOLAS. SOLAS is the Scots word, the Gaelic word for light. So although I live in England, we are headquartered, the organization I lead, in Scotland. And we do two things. We love taking the gospel out of the four walls of churches and helping churches and university groups put on evangelistic events that engage people's questions, whether that's on campus or in cafes, pubs, restaurants, hotels. We find if we go where non-Christian people actually are, there's a spiritual interest out there, even though they may not come across the four walls of our church, doorsteps of our churches at first. And then we love teaching and training and equipping Christians to feel more confident and talk about their faith with their friends and their neighbors. And if you want to find out more about us, there's our website. But without further ado, let us dive in then to this morning's theme and thinking about questions and how we engage with them. And the first thing I want to observe is that the fear, I think, there's a fear that many Christians have of being asked tough questions. In fact, just because you're an academic doesn't make you immune from that fear. I know when I was at university and when I was then in the workplace, I didn't really talk about my faith a lot in my 20s. I kept my faith quite to myself. And looking back, I think one of the reasons I did that was I was afraid. I was afraid of what would happen if I talk about my faith at work or on campus and someone asks me a question about science or about suffering or about sexuality or about a topic that begins with a letter other than F. You know, what would happen? How bad might it be? And so what I want to do this morning is help you, if that's a fear that you have or you feel ill-equipped in some of the tough questions that may get thrown at you if you're more public in your faith, rather than teach you particular answers to particular questions, that's great to do that, I want to teach you a five-fold framework, a five-step framework that can help us begin to get a handle on any question, even if it's one you've never had before. But before we get there, let's begin by noting that sadly, the church sometimes has a bad reputation when it comes to questions. Sometimes in the church, we have a bad reputation when it comes to questions. I remember some years ago when I was living in Canada. I live in the UK now, but we lived for 6 years in Canada. And my local university was the University of Toronto. And I was regularly on that campus because that was where I finished my PhD off in their wonderful library. And I remember on one occasion talking to a student I met on campus there. And when he found out I was a Christian, he very quickly said to me, he said, "Oh, that's interesting." He said, "You know, I used to be a Christian, but I'm not any longer." And interestingly, there was a sort of note of sadness in his voice. He wasn't triumphalistic. It's almost quite a sad comment. So I said to him, I said, "Oh, I'm interested to hear that. What happened? What's your story?" And he said, "Oh, it's simple, really." He said, "I was raised in a very fundamentalist church, very, very rigid, very, very fundamentalist church." He said, where really we were just told what to believe and left to get on with it. But then he said, "In my teens, I fell in love with science. So I came to the University of Toronto to study biology." And he said, "I very quickly discovered that I was being taught things at university that contradicted what I'd been taught in church." Obviously, big one, the book of Genesis. I was being taught the theory of evolution on campus, and at church, it was just, you know, 6 day creation and that kind of thing. And I was struggling to answer these questions. "So what did you do?" I said. He said, "Well, I booked an appointment with the pastor to talk about this." I said, "Oh, fantastic." I said, "Because there are so many great books that will help you with that. Presumably your pastor, did he introduce you to some of the ways you can think about these things?" And the student said, "Well, no, not exactly." I said, "What do you mean, not exactly? What did your pastor do?" And the student said, "My pastor was totally dismissive. My pastor looked at me and said, 'It's really easy, son. It's really easy. Choose the Bible or choose biology. Next question, please.' So what did you do?" I asked. "Simple. I chose biology." Now, I have to confess, that conversation moved me almost to tears. Actually, I was deeply saddened because although thankfully I was able to introduce the student to some great resources on that question, you know, stuff written by Christians in the sciences, there'd been a huge amount of damage done. That clueless pastor had dismissed a perfectly valid question. He hadn't asked the question back. He hadn't taken the time to understand. He hadn't offered any help. And in so doing, that young guy had taken the obvious conclusion, there are no answers, and had walked away. So as we speak with our friends, neighbors, colleagues, classmates, peers on campus, it is essential that if they have questions or objections to our faith, it's just absolutely crucial that we do our very, very best to address them. So in a minute, I'm going to show you, as I say, five simple steps that you can use for beginning to answer all kinds of questions. But briefly, before we come to there, let me just share with you some crucial principles that we should bear in mind when we have these kind of conversations. When we're engaging with friends, neighbors, colleagues who have tough questions, just some guiding principles before we leap in. First one, and this I think is crucial for academics because we are, you know, men and women who like the life of the mind, otherwise we wouldn't be academics. Remember, our task is to answer the questioner, not the question. By which I mean, behind every question, there's a person with a story. And if you're not careful, particularly if you're wired intellectually, you can leap straight into, right, yes, I know the answer to this one, let me tell you the answer to this question. And you've missed the fact you need to engage with the person. So just remember, our goal is to answer the questioner, and the question is secondary. And sometimes, by the way, we may come to this, we go, sometimes the question that's presented with is not the issue. I've had people present with one question, and then you talk to them for a while, and it turns out something else is going on. And so, yeah, just remember, our task is to answer the questioner. Second thing, remember to clarify a question. Again, for those of us wired intellectually, it can be easy if someone asks a question to go straight into answer mode. You know, someone asks you a question about faith and science next week, and you're like, well, I was at ELF and I heard Sharon Dirks give this great talk. Let me tell you in half an hour what she said. And your poor friend is like, whoa. Start by clarifying. I always find when someone asks me a question, I like to begin by asking things like, that's a great question. Why do you ask it? It can be an interesting thing to ask. You might clarify a word, for example. Someone says to you, there's no evidence that God exists. I can't see how you can be a Christian. Rather than leap in and start giving them 10 reasons, what about if you said, hey, interesting you use the word evidence. What do you mean by evidence? What does that word mean to you? What would you need to see or hear? And then why do you think things is an interesting question to ask. If someone says to you, you know, I can't trust the Bible, I don't think it's reliable, don't, again, leap straight into defending the word of God. What about beginning by saying, well, that's interesting. What is it you've read or heard that's led you to that conclusion? Why is it you think what you do? And that forced your friend to do some work. And so instinctively think, I want to lead with a question before I start answering. By the way, notice that Jesus does this all the time. Jesus asks 307 questions in the Gospels. He only answers 8 directly. Those statistics should give us a clue that questions are very, very powerful. And thirdly, important one, be willing to admit your limitations. You can do a lot of damage if somebody asks you a question that you don't know the answer to and you really try and fudge it and mess around and just do a ham-fisted job of it. It is much better for the gospel, actually, if you say, that's a brilliant question. I really confess I don't immediately know the answer. But if that question matters to you, leave it with me and I will find the answer. And then be good to your word. Do the research. Talk to an older, wiser Christian. Read a book. Do a web search. The one exception to this is there are some questions for which probably every Christian should have an answer. The most obvious one for me is the problem of suffering, because we live in this broken, messy world. An old Christian friend says to you, how can you be a Christian with all this suffering in the world? We've had the COVID pandemic. We've got Putin in Ukraine. How can you be a Christian with suffering in the world? If your response is, well, do you know what? I've never really thought about I don't really know. They're not going to think you're humble. They're going to think you're naive. So there are some things that probably, as a disciple of Christ in a complicated world, you just need to have thought about a little bit. But often, admit your limitations. Right. Those basic principles in place. I get at last to the main course. What are these 5 steps? I hear you cry. Well, you're not crying out. You're a very modest audience this morning. But I was expecting someone by now to go, get on with it. We want 5 steps. I like lists. And I'm an academic. So I've given you an acronym this morning. I have 5 steps for you this morning based around the word share. That took 6 hours to come up with that acronym. I hope you're impressed. I juggled words all morning before finally I found some that fit. 5 steps that you should go for when you're faced with a questioner. So here's the first one. The first step you need to do is sympathize. When someone asks a question, begin by sympathizing, affirm the questioner. For example, you know, saying to somebody, that's a great question, is a wonderful way to begin. You know, affirm the person who's asked you the question. If you've had that question in the past yourself, great way to make a connection, to say, you know, it's a brilliant question. I remember I used to ask that question myself. Anything that builds rapport with the person that you're talking with, because now you're engaging as human beings, not just as brains on sticks. So sympathize, make a connection with a person. Next thing you can do is you want to look for the hidden assumptions. Every question has assumptions lurking below the surface, things that the questioner has brought into the conversation and has probably not realized they've done so. And you want to explore those. Now, in a minute, we're going to do a couple of worked examples and show you how that works. For now, just hold that idea in your minds that you want to look for the hidden assumptions in the question. Thirdly, we're going to look to apply the Bible. As we begin engaging with our friend's question, what you want to do is begin gently encouraging them to think about that question from the perspective of the Bible. I've often found over the years that questions that can look quite daunting when you first encounter them can sometimes look quite different when you walk up to the foot of the cross and you look at them from that perspective. So A is for apply the Bible. Fourthly, you want to retell the gospel story through the question. This to me is one of the most crucial ones. That again, for those of us who love the life of the mind, we can get obsessed with giving clever, intellectually robust answers to questions, and that's great, but that's not the end goal. The end goal is that our friend sees Jesus clearly. So it's always worth asking, whatever the question, is there a way that we can use it to bring people to take a look at Christ? And then finally, and then we'll do a couple of worked examples, E is for equip your friend. If your friend has asked a complex question and you've only got a short time to talk, probably you can only skate across the surface of the question. But can you leave your friend with a resource to equip them? Can you direct them to a podcast or a blog post or a website article or a book or a resource that you can encourage them to read, to watch, to go deeper into the topic? Anything they can follow up later. So those are the five steps that I like to follow when I've faced with a question, whether it's a question from my next door neighbor, whether it's a student I've met on campus, whether it's, you know, somebody who has come to a Solas evangelism event. I always like to use these five steps in my mind as I engage with them. But I hear you cry quietly and modestly. This looks great, Andy. What does this look like in practice? So let me show you two worked examples, and then I'm going to get you back into your groups and give you 10 minutes to have a go at applying this framework to a third example and have a crack at it yourself. So let's take a worked example, and let's take one of the biggest questions of all. Maybe this was a question that got shared in your discussion group some moments ago. The whole question of pain and suffering. If God exists, why is there pain and suffering? That's one of the most common questions I hear as an evangelist. You know, how can you be a Christian, people say to us, given the pain, the suffering, the messy, broken, hurting world we find ourselves in? Sometimes the question comes in sharper form. The person asking it is asking something specific. If God is good, why did my friend get attacked? If God is good, why did my sister die of cancer? I was sharing in our small group that the toughest question I ever had was about 15 years ago when someone was asking a question about a double suicide. A friend of theirs had lost two dear friends of theirs who both committed suicide within a week of each other. Where was God? Their friend was asking when that goes on. So let's think about how we might use our share method in beginning to address this question. And remember, we're only skating over the surface here. We've got a short time together this morning. If you were having a conversation, perhaps over coffee or something, you might take 2-3 hours, depending on the time you've got. But I'll give you, hopefully give you a few thoughts that you could perhaps weave into such a conversation. So the first thing we do, of course, is sympathize. And particularly on this question, I would want to really thank the person for asking it, especially if there's a personal component to it. I would want to thank them for their honesty. I would want to identify with the pain and go, I'm so sorry to hear what happened. That must have been awful. I will often on this question want to talk about how I've thought about this question and wrestled with it over the years, especially when suffering has struck close to home. We had a close family friend of ours some years ago was attacked and robbed in the street and beaten up so badly he was never able to work again. That brought evil home to us. And then a few years ago, about 10 years ago, when we were trying to start a family, my wife and I had a series of miscarriages and we lost several pregnancies. I will often use one or other of those examples or bereavements or so forth to show I've thought about this question as well. I really hear where you're coming from. We need to make that connection, particularly on this question. So that's the sympathetic part. What's next? Hidden assumptions. Well, this is the interesting thing with this question. I always want to say to people, it's interesting that it's not just Christians who have to wrestle with this question. All of us have to wrestle with the questions of evil and suffering. For example, if you are an atheist, there are questions to ask here too. One question you have as an atheist is, why does evil and suffering and pain seem so wrong? If humans are just a collection of atoms and particles, why does it matter what happens to them? Why does anyone ultimately care? Furthermore, where is it we've gotten the idea from that suffering and death are not right? I mean, aren't they just part of nature if we live in a natural world? And by the way, once you start throwing words like good and evil around, if you want to sit there and say, well, what Putin is doing is evil, the challenge you have as an atheist is, how do you get to say? Who decides? Aren't those just personal preferences in a godless universe? And I would often want to say to my friend at this point, look, Christians have some questions to answer. Oh, of course we do. I just want to suggest to them that I wonder whether Christianity, right at the start, gives us this slightly better framework for talking about these things. In fact, C.S. Lewis, who was an atheist for about half his life, once remarked, looking back on his 30 years as an atheist, he said, back then when I was an atheist, my argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and so unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he first has some idea of a straight line. So there's a whole area of hidden assumptions here that we can explore. And we don't do this, by the way, in some sort of gotcha type moment. We don't want to try and score points off our friend and go, ha ha, you got problems too. We want to do it by getting them thinking and getting them realizing there's more to this than they may have realized. Next up, we come to the third step, apply the Bible. And I'll often say to skeptical friends as we're talking about these kind of questions that one of the things I find so helpful about Christianity is the Bible is so honest about evil and suffering. In the very first couple of pages, it talks about the fact, doesn't it, that the world is not the way that God intended it to be. The Bible doesn't say, hey, the world is really wonderful, just, you know, close your eyes and don't look at the bad stuff. The Bible is very honest that something has gone radically wrong with God's good creation, caused as human beings try to throw God out of the picture and make ourselves the center of the story. But the Bible, I would also want to say to them, is clear that pain and suffering, evil and death are not the last word. They're not the end of the story, because the Bible, of course, tells this much bigger story of God's plans to restore and renew and rescue his creation and destroy evil once and for all. And I sometimes like to just, you know, with a twinkle in my eye, say to a skeptical friend, I wonder whether when we naturally react with horror at suffering or death or injustice, as we do, all human beings, if they're functioning normally, look at evil and death and injustice and react against it. I often say, I wonder when we react that way, whether we are instinctively revealing that all of us know in the very deepest fiber of our being that the biblical story is true. We know that death and evil and injustice are not what should be happening. And the Bible gives us a framework for those hunches. Well, we don't just want to end there, do we? We want to do our fourth step. We want to retell the gospel. And I often point out to people, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? When we think about evil and suffering and injustice, what most of us want when we see evil and suffering is not something said about it. We don't want a clever academic answer. We want something done about it. When we see injustice, we want something done. And that's why we admire people who dedicate their lives to fighting injustice, why we dedicate who dedicate their lives to demonstrating compassion. I picked the word compassion there deliberately because I always want to get to that word in the conversation. Why? For this reason. Compassion is a fascinating word, the English word compassion. It's comprised of two Latin words, com, that means with, and passion, that means suffer. And so compassion literally means to suffer alongside. If you are a compassionate person, it means you are going to do something about suffering, but that costs you in the process. You're not just going to help remotely. You're going to get so involved that it's going to cost you personally. And at the heart of my Christian faith, I want to say to my friends, is I believe in a God who is compassionate, a God who hasn't simply said something about evil and suffering, but a God who in the cross of Christ has done something about evil and suffering, disarming it and defeating it at Calvary. But of course, that defeat came at great price. We see in Jesus a God of compassion, a God who doesn't just merely enable us to name evil as evil, but a God who in Jesus dealt with it and gave us as Christians the certain hope that one day evil will be gone forever. Now, as you walk through that, no doubt your friend will ask all kinds of other questions, and that's fine. That's what a conversation looks like, but that's the kind of rough framework I would use. But there's much more that can be said. This is a particularly good area where it's useful to be aware of some great resources that you can connect your friend to and leave them with. Just three that I would mention and commend to you. On the left, we have Sharon Dirks, who was in this very room yesterday. He was not just a brilliant expert on brain and science and stuff, also wrote a wonderful book on suffering called Why. That's really worth checking out. You've also got Where is God in All the Suffering by a friend of mine called Amy Orr Ewing, another brilliant academic and evangelist. And on the end, Beyond the Big Sea by a friend of mine called Jeremy Marshall. Amazing book. Jeremy has been wrestling with cancer for many years. And that book is a phenomenal book on what it means as a Christian to be basically dying of cancer and doing that well. And what I like about all three of those books, they're all personal. Not one of them is here's an academic answer. All of them are very biblical, very, 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 very well-written books, but they're all also grounded in people who have suffered personally. And they're great gifts to give to skeptical friends. So that's the first example. And if you put your email address down on that clipboard, by the way, I will send you the slides, which will have all of those resources on. I saw people taking photographs, so you can get those and have a look. Let's take a look at a second example that sometimes comes up, a question I often get asked, and then I say, well, I'll get you guys to work on one. Let's think about another tough question. What about the violence in the Old Testament? This is a question I often get, particularly from people who've had any kind of Christian background and walked away. What do we do with the fact the Old Testament can be quite bloodthirsty in places? How can you believe in a God of love? I've been asked, who commands Israelites to kill the Canaanites? Or one atheist friend actually put it even more bluntly. He said, isn't the God of Christians schizophrenic? He's a God of love in the New Testament. He's a God of violence in the Old Testament. There's no way you can reconcile them. The whole thing is nonsense. Tough question. How do we begin thinking about that one? Well, let's again think about what our five-step share framework might look like. So let's begin with S. Rather than sort of leap in and go all academic on people, at least at first, why don't we begin by sympathizing? So whenever I'm asked this question, I always like to say, do you know what? That's a really good question. And I think the question has a point, right? I often say, I can understand why you ask it. There are passages in, for example, the book of Joshua that when I read, even today after being a Christian for 40 years, I still sometimes find myself thinking, yes, that is quite... It's quite direct. And if as Christians we haven't wondered how some of that Old Testament stuff fits with Jesus' command to lay down your sword and love your enemies, then at the very least, perhaps we haven't quite read carefully enough. So acknowledge the question. It's a good question. There are good answers to it, but it's a good question. So what are the hidden assumptions in this question? What are the things that our questioner has assumed but may not have realized? Well, one question I like to ask people is, hey, do you think, or have you ever wondered, if there are occasions when violence is permitted? Are there times when violence is permissible? And if so, what might those be? That's a really interesting question. Because most people instinctively assume that, what happened during the Second World War, when the Allies fought back against the Nazis, that was a good thing. Most people think that resisting what's going on in Ukraine and Putin's expansionary dreams is a good idea. So presumably there's a time when violence is okay. What do those look like? Get your friend thinking about that. If your friend is nevertheless deeply committed to pacifism, you might ask the question, just out of interest, where do you think the value that you hold, that love and peace are supreme values, where do they come from? Where do those values come from? After all, if we live in a purely naturalistic universe, where natural selection is the only game in town, to quote the atheist Richard Dawkins, then presumably the triumph of the strong over the weak is just part of the great game of life, right? That's what happens. The weak creature gets eaten and the stronger survives. And so I want to say to my friends, I think the very fact that we read the Old Testament and we say, oh, gosh, that's tough, that's a sign of how deeply Jesus' ethics have seeped into our culture. that actually our friend who asked the question has actually themselves taken on board the ethic of Jesus. That's why they're asking the question in the first place. So how might we then move on to our third step and apply the Bible? Well, I was something to say to friends who asked this question, did you know that the question of how God's love and how God's judgment fit together is not a question we discovered in the 21st century, but is actually a question raised by the Bible itself? The Bible itself wrestles with that question, which is just interesting, right? So, for example, scholars will tell us that one of the oldest books of the Bible is the book of Jonah. And if you remember in the book of Jonah, there's this moment at the end where Jonah has this massive complaint about God's character. You know, God has sent him to preach to the Assyrians, the hated, oppressive Assyrians. Jonah's run away, gone the opposite direction, has got thrown off a boat into a whale, vomited up on the beach. He's gone to preach to Nineveh, and amazingly, they've all repented and God's forgiven them. And rather than hold a worship service and celebrate what's happened, Jonah goes absolutely nuts and sits under his tree and has this huge, great grumble at God. Remember what he says? Isn't this what I said, Lord? Said Jonah. Isn't this what I said when I was still at home? This is what I tried to forestall by fleeing to Tarshish, because I knew that you are a gracious and a compassionate God, that you're slow to anger, you're abounding in love, you're a God who relents from sending calamity. So God, Lord, take away my life, for it's better for me to die than to live. So in other words, Jonah has a problem with God's love and God's judgment and the way they clash. In his case, he's got it the other way around. His complaint is, God, you're too kind, you're too merciful, you're too darn compassionate. And Jonah is wrestling with how love and judgment fit together. But you see, the Bible doesn't see these things as contradictory. The Bible would say that God's judgment flows out of his love, because the opposite of love is not judgment. The opposite of the word love is not the word judgment. If I truly love somebody, I will care deeply if they are wronged and hurt or oppressed. And that, says the Bible, is one of the reasons, not the only one, but one of the reasons that God acts in judgment. He loves the world that he has made. And when he sees injustice, evil, violence, and the consequences of sin, God will bring judgment. And now, of course, coming back to the book of Joshua that I mentioned in the setup for this, we see something similar going on, don't we? The Israelites were not asked to go and wipe out a nation of vegan, kitten-hugging, pacifistic knitting enthusiasts. Rather, what we know from the Old Testament and from history, incidentally, is that Canaanite society was a truly evil one. It was one in which children were burnt alive in the worship of the god Molech, and all kinds of other stuff was going on. And we also know from the Bible that God doesn't rush to judgment. Earlier in the Old Testament, God says to Abraham that he will give the Canaanites 400 years, and after that, judgment will fall. And what I'm trying to do in bringing that into the conversation, tough as it may sometimes be, is I'm trying to help my friends see the wider story. Because when you get the context of a story, it can change how you see things. Context is crucial. Let me illustrate what I mean. Imagine you had never seen one of the greatest movies of all time, Star Wars. If there are any non-sci-fi fans here, come and talk to me afterwards. I will pray for you. Imagine you have never seen the movie Star Wars, and you walk into a room where a couple of friends are watching it, and you come in towards the end, and the very, very first thing you see on the screen as you walk through the door is Luke Skywalker firing his missile at the Death Star and blowing the whole thing up in a fiery explosion. And your reaction is to shout at your friends, What insanity are you watching? What kind of hellish movie is this? That's horrific. That guy with the bad haircut and the wooden delivery is a monster. He's just killed thousands of people. And in one sense, you'd be right. He has just killed thousands of people. But you're missing the bigger picture. You've missed all the story about the evil empire, the destruction the Death Star has wrought as it's destroyed entire planets and people. You've missed that, and so you don't understand what's gone on. If you locate the act of judgment, though, in the bigger story, then it makes much more sense and it looks very different. You've got to get the wider story. And then, of course, we come to how we retell the gospel through this thorny question. How do we do that? Well, I often like to look for ways to say to people, I'm struck, the more I read the Bible, I'm struck by the parallels between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Remember, your friend may not know that the Bible was written over 1,500 years of history by 40 different authors, massive, great volume of books. We see the Bible today as one book, but of course it's a library, and your friends don't understand this. And so some of the parallels between the Old Testament and the New are fascinating. And one fascinating parallel is that in Hebrew, and the names Jesus and Joshua are the same. It's the same name in the Hebrew, and it has the same meaning. It means the Lord saves. So interesting, right? In both halves of the Bible, a guy with the same name goes to war against evil. Joshua's war against evil was one that used the sword, and it used warfare, and its results were temporary. It was a temporary victory. At the very best, what Joshua did in the Old Testament was a pointer forward to a much greater battle to come. And in that much greater battle, Jesus warred against evil. He fought against evil, not with weapons, but with self-sacrificial love. And he destroyed evil once and for all by laying down power and letting violence do its worst to him. And even as he hung there on the cross, he publicly forgave his enemies who had nailed him there. And I say to folks, you know, talk of enemies is interesting, isn't it? Because as we ask questions about the Old Testament, particularly, it's very easy to sit in judgment on it. It's very easy to sit there and go, well, we're the good guys, and over here there's all this bad stuff happening. But I sometimes like to look for opportunities to say to my friend, I wonder if it's ever struck you that the Bible doesn't let us get off the hook. The Bible tells us that we are all God's enemies because we've turned our backs on him. But thankfully, the God of the Bible is in Jesus, a God who loved his enemies and laid his life down for them, and offers, if we put our trust in him, to make us, his enemies, his friends. Well, like the previous question, we've covered a lot. The conversation may unfold in different directions. Good to leave your friends with something to wrestle with and think about and read. Three resources I can recommend. Skeletons in God's Closet by Joshua Ryan Butler. Brilliant book, looking not just at war of the Old Testament, but also looking at hell and judgment and those issues more generally. Really accessible book, helping people think about those questions and see the gospel through them. On the right-hand side, David Lamb's book, God Behaving Badly, which I love the title in that book, Is the God of the Old Testament Angry, Sexist, and Racist? Again, I love the fact it addresses the question head-on. Really good book for someone who's wrestling with these things. And then in the middle, shameless plug, on the Solas website, we have a resource called Short Answers. These are about 160 five-minute videos answering a lot of the tough questions our friends ask in very non-Christian friendly ways. And we've got quite a lot on this topic. So you can go have a search through that and find a video to share with your friend. Right, two questions down. Now the fun really begins. Our third question then is another one I hear increasingly frequently these days. How can you claim Christianity is uniquely true given all the other religions in the world? Where I grew up in London, you know, you could choose from Hinduism, Buddhism, Sikhism, Jainism, Judaism, secularism, Islamism. You could even support the local football team, Crystal Palace. We call that masochism. All those different isms. Thank you for laughing at that. And all those different isms. So how can Christians claim that Jesus is uniquely true? Doesn't that look arrogant and intolerant and just unbelievably narrow-minded? Get that question a lot. So what I'd like you to do is turn to the people you were with earlier, and let's take 8 minutes, because I want some time left for a couple of questions at the end. We take 8 minutes and have a play around with it. How might you begin to dig into this question using the share method? And I've put it on the screen to remind you. Sympathize, hidden assumptions, apply the Bible, retell the gospel, and equip your friend to that question of the uniqueness of Christianity and what of other faiths. Over to you for the next 8 minutes. Go for it. I realize we could take vastly more time on this time because we only actually had, by the time we had the announcements out the way, we had an hour kind of this morning. So it's a great exercise to go through at a great length, but I hope you found it helpful. Let me just share with you a few thoughts very quickly, not to leave you hanging, but you probably came up with all kinds of wisdom in your groups. What would I say around this? Sympathize, definitely want to make a great connection on. If you've got friends in other faiths, that's a great way of doing it. You can talk about the fact you have friends in other faiths. Over the years, I often talk about the joke I did growing a moment ago. I talk about growing up in London, very diverse. London, one of the most diverse cities in the world. It's fantastic. All the different nations and beliefs that have come in through immigration. It's wonderful. I love that richness, but it does raise this kind of question. So I get it. It's a good It's a good question. So show the person you've been thinking about it. Hidden assumptions. One hidden assumption, I think, behind this question that I sometimes like to tease out is, you know, just out of interest, what precisely is it about Christian exclusivity that that you find difficult? After all, Muslims, Buddhists, and Jews all make exclusive truth claims. Atheists, too, by the way, do, too. Atheists think everybody else is wrong and atheism is correct. And by the way, even if you try and cheekily say, well, I believe that all religions are true, you are actually excluding the person who thinks that only one religion is true. So you can't get away from this. And maybe there's something about the nature of truth, right, that makes it exclusive. You know, after all, Paris is either the capital of France or it isn't. 2 + 2 is either 4 or it's something else. Perhaps it's the very nature of truth to be exclusive. And perhaps the question is not, is this an exclusive truth claim, but how can we handle those who think differently to us graciously? Applying the Bible, how might we do this? Well, again, I sometimes want to say to people, it's interesting, right? There's loads of confusion, isn't there, around the word God. We can sometimes assume that when we use the word God in a conversation, everyone means the same thing. So when my Muslim friends say they believe in God, when my atheist friends say they don't believe in God, when my Hindu friend says they believe in millions of gods, and I say I believe in one God, everyone around the table assumes we're using God the same way. But I'm not sure that is true. And I think the Bible introduces the idea, actually, there are lots of competing ideas about God out there, and it's crucial to know which God we are talking about. Furthermore, you'll sometimes hear people say things, well, couldn't every religion, you know, lead to God? You know, couldn't every path lead to the top of the mountain or so on? And it's interesting observing that actually only the Bible makes the claim that we can get to God. Only the Bible promises to lead us to God. Some religions will claim to lead you to annihilation and non-existence. Some religions will claim that you'll end up being sort of absorbed into the cosmic oneness. Some religions, like the Quran and Islam, claim to lead you to paradise. The Quran does not claim to lead you to God. It claims to lead you to paradise, where there'll be rivers of wine and fruit trees and beautiful young women for the men to enjoy, but God is somewhat absent. By contrast, it's only the Bible that offers out this promise of an eternal relationship with God in the new heavens and the new earth. The God who walks and talks with Adam and Eve in Genesis, the God who stepped into history, the person of Jesus, is the God who in Revelation 21 talks about dwelling with his people once again into the future. That's a unique Christian claim. And when you say that, it's quite fun because you can turn to the person you're talking to and say, if I've got that wrong, please do show me another religion that makes that claim, because I don't think there is one. Retold the gospel, so many ways to do this, but the obvious way of doing it is when people raise this objection to Christian claims of exclusivity, to just gently point out that's actually not a Christian claim in one sense. It's a Jesus claim. Jesus is the one who said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to God except through me. So at the very least, the person, their problem is with Jesus, not with me as his follower. But the interesting thing is, although this is often framed as a religious question, I sometimes like to point out to people that actually it's interesting that Jesus was in some ways the most irreligious founder of any world religion. So I talked about words being interesting. God is an interesting word. Religion is another interesting word. Interesting to ask your friend what they think the word religion means. I think many anthropologists and sociologists would say, well, religions are systems of thought and structure and so forth that say that if you think the right things, Buddhism works this way on thought. If you have the right experience, lots of Eastern religions work that way. Or if you keep the right commandments, Islam would work that way, then you can sort of climb your way up to heaven and somehow get closer to God, satiate the spiritual hunger within. But the problem in all those systems is it makes you the center of the picture. It's your thinking, it's your experiencing, it's your doing that somehow gets you closer to God and so on. By contrast, the Bible flips the whole script and says, you can think all the thoughts you want, you have all the experiences you want, do all the stuff you want. It doesn't work because we can't climb up to heaven because the gap is too great, but Jesus has climbed down to us. So actually, am I cheekiest when someone says, do all religions lead to God, or a variation of it? I like to sometimes respond, what if no religion leads to God? What if no religion leads to God, but what if God could lead us to God, which is what I think as a Christian has happened in Jesus? Well, as with all these questions, we've just scratched the surface, particularly this one got at high speed. How could you equip your friend? Well, 3 books that I found helpful, and if you're getting the slides, you'll have these come round to you. 3 books that I found really helpful on this topic over the years. Well, two actually, because one I can't say I found helpful. That's very cheeky, that third one. First one, Three Theories of Everything, written by a friend of mine called Ellis Potter. Ellis was a Buddhist monk for many years before he became a Christian. And it's a brilliant story, really, of his journey from Buddhism through atheism into Christianity. Three Theories of Everything. And it's a little book. It's less than 100 pages. It's a commendable when authors write succinctly. Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus by Nabil Qureshi. Nabil died a few years ago, but was a dear friend of mine, Muslim convert to Christianity. And that's an amazing story of how someone who set out wanting to know more of God found that it was Jesus at the end of the path. And it's a it's an astonishing book of for the differences. Some guy called Andy Bannister wrote a book called Do Muslims and Christians Worship the Same God, which really uses that question to unpack all of the differences between Christianity and Islam. And it has the benefit of having comedy footnotes as well. And lastly, the Short Answers video series that I mentioned before. We've got loads of videos in there around this question. Do take a look. So with practice, we can learn to ask, use this framework on all kinds of questions. So we sympathize, we look at the hidden assumptions, we apply the Bible, we retell the gospel story, we equip our friend. But as we seek to answer the questions of our friends and colleagues, last thought I want to leave you with, and we'll have a couple of questions, if there are any from the floor. Let's remember what we are doing. We are not trying to win an argument. We're not trying to show off intellectually. And we are certainly not laboring under the ridiculous assumption that we can argue people into God's kingdom. It's a crazy idea. We can't do that. What are we doing? Well, I mentioned C.S. Lewis earlier. One of his dear friends was a guy called Austin Farrer, who was a pastor and theologian. And he once said this about what arguments can do. And I think he nails it perfectly. He says, argument does not create conviction. Argument cannot create conviction, but the lack of it destroys belief. What seems to be proved may not be embraced, but what no one shows the ability to defend is quickly abandoned. Rational argument does not create belief, but it maintains a climate in which belief may flourish. And I love that idea, that what we're doing, we're answering people's questions, and we're engaging what you can call apologetics, if you like long words, is that we're not creating faith, but we can, with wisdom and humility and with the Spirit's empowering, maybe we can just remove some of the debris that helps people, prevents people from seeing Jesus clearly. And everything I've taught this morning, by the way, comes from my kind of new book. I've got a book in the summer out, coming out, called How to Talk About Jesus Without Looking Like an Idiot. This comes out in August. I have, by miraculous strong arming and of my publisher, managed to get, I brought 10 copies to ELF. I've sold half of them. So I brought five with me this morning. If you'd like to get hold of that book 2 months ahead of release, come talk to me at the coffee break. I will happily kind of sell you and sign you a copy. And what I've taught this morning is a condensed version of one chapter in here.